This is December the 11th, 2007. I'm Dr. Donald Smith from Cornell University. I'm here in Binghamton, New York, with Dr. John Ayers, class of 1939, and his daughter, Chris Ayers. And we're conducting this interview as part of the Legacy Research Project to document the historical legacies of some of the great Cornellians. Dr. Ayers, it's a pleasure to be here. And I would like you to talk about your life growing up, where your parents came from, how you decided to become a veterinarian, and then how you got to Cornell.
Okay, I was born in Coorsville, New York, the youngest of five children. My father and mother operated a dairy farm but did not own it. In addition, they took in two orphans, and my father had a crippled uncle, so that made 10 of us at the table. That farm, when my father couldn't buy it, we moved, and my father operated feed mills for other people, but eventually he was able to buy the farm, so I moved back there when I was about 10 years old, and then he functioned that and still operate in the feed business. And the veterinarians coming to our farm always impressed me. And in those days, I could ride with those veterinarians, and I did. And I think the outstanding one to me was Dr. Markham, who always an advisor and a close friend to me until the day he died. He probably, more than anyone else, was instrumental in my thinking about veterinary medicine. However, my older brother wrote to Cornell, and he got data on veterinary medicine, and I kept reading it, and the more I looked at it, we got that dentistry and other things also, I should add. That one appealed to me because I was always handling the chickens and the pigs and other things like that on the farm as a kid. I leaned towards them. I followed through thinking, well, I'll try it. I'll try to get in, because I was told then one out of eight would be selected for veterinary medicine. One out of eight that applied, one would get in. And I thought, well, I might be the one. And my mother and I talked it over. I went to Cornell. I decided I'd be an extension agent, Farm Bureau, with the Farm Bureau in those days if I didn't get in veterinary medicine. So I was admitted, and between pre-vet and my first year in the veterinary college, my father had a stroke. Whatever business he had developed went down the tube.
Dad, tell them about when you went to talk to them about getting into veterinary school.
When I went for my interview, I can remember that Dr. Frost, who became one of my best friends, was Professor of Large Animal Medicine. He, I believe, rode in on me more than else. He said, I understand you're working more time than you're in class up in the Ag College. And I said, well, I'm doing what I can with Farm Home. And he said, well, you can't do it in the Veterinary College. And I said, I'll do it. He said, I just told you you couldn't do it. And I apparently said back to him, as he reminded me years later, well, I'll do it. He turned to the other and said, I guess he'll do it. So when I went back in the fall after my father had the stroke and everything he had almost went down the tube, held down the old farm, I went back determined to work my way through the veterinary college as well as I could. In my pre-vet year, I had met Dr. Stone, who was ahead of me, and he was from Binghamton, and he worked under Dr. Birch. And with his guidance, I joined Alpha Psi, so I moved in my freshman year to Alpha Psi and got a job waiting on table with three or four other veterinarians. I remember Walter Dennis, Phil Close, Bill Reese, and at least three of them. That sustained me pretty well from that standpoint, but then the rent was up the about $3 a week. It definitely was in my pre-vet year at the Alpha Psi house. It was about the same, so I was scratching gravel, but there was a loan fund then at the veterinary college, and if I got through the freshman year, as I understood it, I could borrow from that fund. Well, by the end of the freshman year, I had done well enough that I got into the sophomore year, and then I could borrow from that fund. So in the sophomore year, that fund carried me through pretty well. I lived in Alpha Psi and roomed with Frank Birch, who later was assistant director of DAI in Albany. That summer, I went to work for veterinarian Dr. Howard in Endicott. He had just started his veterinary practice there, leaving Dr. Markham in Binghamton. So I worked the summer with him. When I went back in the fall, I was better able to get more work. So I coasted through the sophomore year pretty well with the Guiteau Fund loan. Keeping in mind that there was rooms in within the veterinary college, and that year, then I got into the veterinary college basement. There was a room there. I roomed with Bob Johnson, who did not get in the veterinary college but went to work in the diagnostic laboratory. He had a girlfriend downtown, and he was down there as much as home. When vacation time would come, especially Christmas, that was probably the most lonely time for me, because I never went home for Christmas, even though it was 50 miles away, after I was admitted to veterinary college. The others that did go home were leaving their part-time jobs, and I had filled them. So if my pocket was empty of money at the beginning of the Christmas season, when they came back, my pockets would be filled with money, in effect, so it would carry me. And that carried on with me from the financial standpoint, living in the college and paying no rent, but just having work to do at the large animal clinic. What did I do to justify living there? I cleaned stables on weekends, helped the regular grooms at the large animal stables, and then I would get paid by pathology or other departments for running the mimeograph machines, which were separate and apart, and that gave me a check adding to it. So someone told me about Haver Glover looking for someone to sell instruments to the students, and I contacted them, and I got that job as a salesman to graduating students, some who want to go right in practice. And my roommate at Alpha Psi was Walter Fallon, John Holmes, for the second year there before I went to the college. And Walter Fallon got the Jensen Salisbury Supply Company as their salesman. So we merged forces. Between the next 2 years, junior and senior year, I paid back the Guiteau Fund, all the money I'd borrowed from them in my underclass years. So when I graduated from Cornell, I came home and I gave my mother $300 on those 40 and 45 and 50 cent per hour jobs. I think the best thing I remember, other than graduating, becoming a veterinarian, of course, was the privilege of being in the library. In the winter season, especially when they're on vacation, I had free access to the library. I think it was the first time in my life I ever saw more books than I could possibly read. And it gave me a love of book reading that I've never forgotten. In those periods when all the students would go home but me, it wouldn't be all the students, there was a Dr. Lyman Hoy who lived in the large animal clinic. There was one room in the large animal clinic between the first floor and the second floor, and Dr. Hoy got in there. He was from Canada, but born in Canada, and then he was in the North Country, and then he decided to become a veterinarian. So he and I would share many a meal together when all the rest of the students, it seemed like, were going home. I say that with no pity for myself, because plenty of others doing. I think of Vincent Bolt lived in the basement of a sorority over in Tripphammer Road. I think of Jim McCarthy, my classmate, who lived in the hospital, the city hospital of Ithaca. And there were a couple that lived and worked as volunteer firemen for Ithaca, and they lived in the fire station that was on College Avenue. And so there, we were coming out of the Depression, and all that I was associated with were all waiting on table or washing dishes. When my work kept filling up at the veterinary college. I was getting more and more work from other professors. I had to give up my job as a waiter at the Kappa Alpha Theta sorority. But I would be then a substitute when I had the time. They'd come by and say, can you take my place tonight? So I worked that part-time afterwards. But it all accrued in the end. So as I say, I came out of Cornell with my diploma and with my commission as lieutenant. I stuck away and forgot in 1939. Having followed that...
Did you want to tell him at all about your first living conditions at Cornell and how you were eating and surviving with the apple orchard? Those are great stories.
Well, when I moved into the veterinary college, the basement, I was in debt to that fund. And so in the fall, I would go out and get fallen apples from the Cornell apple orchard, milk cows, which I did as part of my job, and I learned that the cows that were in the large animal clinic, they'd milk them and pour the milk down the drain, which astounded me. So I asked them, all right, they take a pail down. It was just 50 feet away where I lived. So I made more than one meal out of apples, bread, and milk. And then during vacation time, I would also, there was a building, the postmortem building was a separate building apart from the other. So vacation time, that failed me because I was working pathology. And if, as he did occasionally, bring in a healthy horse with a broken leg to use for dissection in anatomy, I'd be the one to put the bullet in them and skin them and put them on hooks. But it didn't take me long to figure out that I could slice off a few steaks from those horses and take them down and put them in the freezer down James Law, and I'd put my name on them, and all the professors respected it. They thought there was something in the diagnostic laboratory. And I thought I was unusually brilliant because they would call for me to get the alcohol from the basement. And Alpha Psi would be having parties over there, and they thought it was pretty good that I had that job. So it was my job to see that I could sequester 4 ounces of grain alcohol and bring it over and tip it into the punch at the parties. And it wasn't until I graduated that I think it probably was Dr. Olison said to me, well, we'll see now if we can get the records balanced on the alcohol in the basement. The first I knew it, they were on to it all the time. I look back and think how very fortunate I was to live in the college and have the access I did to the professors and the instructors there and the guidance they had. I never knew one of them that I didn't think had the principles of veterinary medicine and the principle of charity pointing out to me my debt as a student who benefited from the land grant, lack of tuition. There, I thank God that I did have free access to the library, and I thank God himself because I think at Cornell, I remembered things my mother told me, rural expressions like, God tempers the wind to the shorn lamb.
Let me ask you about several professors, and just in a word or two, describe your remembering of them. Let's start with Dr. Sunderville.
I had the least contact with him or Dr. Birch most. My contacts were with Dr. Meltz and Dr. Stevenson at Small Animal Clinic. In fact, I was became student instructor my junior and senior year under them. Dr. Frost, and I can't remember his assistant, but the next one was Dr. Danks, who succeeded him in a large animal clinic. And then my guiding light after graduation was Dr. Olison. I think if I look back on ethical things, occasionally he would drop word, ask me if I'm inethical, come in and address his class and tell him what I was doing in Binghamton as city veterinarian. My strongest impression with him was I was cleaning the desk in his classroom and he was in the cubicle, and a fellow that I had thought was most fortunate having his brother sending him a check twice a month, had to go in, and I couldn't help but hear him, and no matter what the student would say, he's saying, you're in the wrong profession. You ought to look at another field. The fellow would wrangle on, and he'd say, no, I think you're in the wrong profession. And I watched that man walk out, and as a continued clean desk, and I thought, that will never happen to me. Looking back today, who was the funniest fellow in our class till he busted out was that one. I had that access to professors that few others had because they didn't live there. I was the only one who lived in James Laws. So I'd be in the hallway and so forth. I used to come from the basement, but it gave me access. I might be doing that and come out and there'd be a professor there and we'd sit and talk. Last time I saw Dr. Hagen, he yelled at me down the hall and he said, I gotta get to the airport by such a time and I see you where you gotta get me there. On the way over to take him to the airport, I had to sit in Binghamton car. He said, what do you think of me as a teacher? Some words to that effect. And I said to him, your best lecture was your first lecture. And he said, why was that? I said, I never forgot when you said to us, look at the person on your right. Look at the person on your left. Well, look at them. Look at them. Well, according to records up here, one of you three will be going home by the first year. Now, we don't decide who's going home. You decide that. So between now and the first year, one of you three will be departing. We leave it up to you because school starts when I leave this platform and it doesn't stop until 4 years from now. Well, he laughs and he said, that's the best you remember? I said, it was the best for me because when I looked at the others, I thought, one's going home, it sure isn't going to be me.
How many started in your class?
Well, I would say some over 40.
But there weren't very many that left your class, as I understand.
No. I was trying to think of George Meredith I'm talking about. His brother was Burgess Meredith, the actor in California. Sent George a check on the 1st and 15th. I looked at it and said, probably the worst thing happened to him. Mm-hmm.
Were there very many people in your class who did have wealth, did have money?
Well, they did. They were over in OTS. They were on, OTS was up on Dryden Road. There were segments in our class like any other. I thought you were going to, and that leads into, was there bigotry there? Well, there was still some there.
Was it related to people who came from the city?
Yes, or? I think that we knew they had better marks, and they were better schooled in many cases, better trained in studying than we were. And whether they had the money or not, they had access to it. I'm not saying they displayed it. Cards were very infrequent there. It wasn't until probably my sophomore or junior year that I knew students that had automobiles. John Holmes, I remember, and Roy Badgley. John Holmes, Roy Badgley, and Walt Fallon, for some reason, all had cars when they were juniors. But I was living over in the college. They were still living in Alpha Psi. But I remember those three because we go a little together, and I always somehow got along great because when we go anywhere and they stop for gas, I'd be right out and give a dollar. In those days, a dollar gas was 8 cents a gallon of gas. And they thought that was great. I was filling up the car, and I knew I was getting it. So I had a great relationship that those three in particular we were in touch for the rest of our lives.
Let me ask you about some other people. I think it was Milton Spiegel who had a pharmacy degree or was an older student.
He was World War One. He was in World War One. He was that much older, I think.
And he had a family.
And those of Jewish faith seemed to me they hung together. And if you don't believe there's bigotry, I was a farm boy, and most of us farm boys just kept our mouths shut. We didn't say anything. In my case, I was a bit sensitive because in 1928, an Irish Catholic ran for president, Al Smith. And I was beat up so badly in country schools that I've said often that time heals the wound but leaves the scar. So I would say that with no hesitancy. If it were today or after I got my degree, I don't my nature such, I wouldn't have permitted. I would have said something, but I didn't. But I've tried to make it up since.
So Isidore Sprecher, did you know Izzy well?
I knew not well. I didn't know any of the Jewish boys well, I'm sorry to say. I met up with him after graduation. He was at Westover Field, and I was at Bradley Field in Connecticut. He was up in Massachusetts. We'd have meal breaks occasionally up there, because when we'd have something in common, why, we'd kind of meet each other at office.
Tell me about, Sunderville was the son of Dr. Sunderville. Did that, having the son of a professor, did that have any impact on that?
Well, I would say no one had more access to their classmates than me, because they lived in the college. And they wanted to come over and work on their specimens sometimes and so forth. I'd have the keys. I had a bundle of keys, and to this day, I don't know why the faculty entrusted me with so many keys. I just don't know. I have Ed Sunderville, I saw, he and Frank Birch, very little of Sunderville. For some reason, Frank Birch would come over to see his father, or stop at his father's office, because it was right above me. I guess I cleaned his office out. Frank got married. I remember he got married while we were there in Sage, and I was in the bridal party. First time I'd ever been in any. And I don't know why he picked me, other than we got to know each other pretty well. The last time I saw him, they made an emergency landing here. I lost track of him completely. And he was working for Carnation Milk. He was with that company. And he called and said, well, I was looking through the veterinarian to find your name. And he said, come on over to my hotel room. We sat, and he didn't know anything much about his classmates. And I told him one thing I knew, and never heard again.
Francis Kwong.
I'd get a letter from him now and then. He had a, what was the Great Leap Forward? Well, he was a victim in that, I gathered. I don't know if he made out some meaning, got beat up or things like that, not that he was killed in, but they had something like the Great Leap Forward. He told me, well, everything is calm down and so forth, but I was trying to read between the lines, and he sort of suffered in it.
How did a man from China become a Cornell student? Do you know that story?
Only in the sense that the government was picking, as other governments did and still do, were trying to get Western ideas indirectly. Mm-hmm. Years later, I got more when I was down to Fort Sam Houston and sitting with an officer from Vietnam. That's, of course, long before our problem there. What was happening was that they would come over here, they would marry an American girl, and then they'd stay. And he would explain how impoverished the countries were, and with the total effort to put him, these young fellas, or girls, I suppose, to come over and get an education, bring it back, only to find they got over here, they married an American girl, and he didn't go back. It strained him pretty badly when they tell me, and I realized I had never considered that. I had no reason to know about it. But countries were trying to put their people over here for years, and that was the gimmick happened far too often. And along that line, one of the most things one happened, I was at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And there was a fellow there, an officer there, in a blue uniform, and he was the head of the Ethiopian army. And I put out his hand, shook hands, and said, you're the second Ethiopian I ever met. He said, oh, that's unusual to meet anyone that knows Ethiopian. Well, I said, I went to Cornell, and ahead of me, I believe he was a senior when I was a freshman, was Angada Yohannes.